Welcome back to Adventures in Theater History. Here on this show, we bring you the best stories from the deep and fascinating history of theater in the city of Philadelphia. I'm your host, Peter Schmitz. Our original theme music is composed by Christopher Mark Colucci. Let me say at the start that this is not the episode about vaudeville in Philadelphia, which I promised you at the end of the last episode. Since that show came out, it's been a rather busy time here at Adventures in Theater History World Headquarters. All sorts of unexpected but fantastic professional opportunities have been popping up, which I hope to be able to speak about soon, but these opportunities have been taking up a lot of the time and the attention of the writing, producing, and research staff here in the AITH Executive Suite, by which I mean just me, of course. I still plan to have that episode ready to go by the end of November. Look for it to drop the Friday after Thanksgiving, 2023. But to keep things rolling here at the podcast, I have gone back into the archives of the bonus episodes that I occasionally release only to our supporters on Patreon. I have taken up one of those episodes and remixed it and added some new material and some additional music. That's what I'm sharing with you today. By the way, you too can become one of these Patreon supporters. Let me thank Rob and Bob, who have just recently signed up there as Patreon patrons. Rob and Bob are not related, I believe, and I thank them for shortening their names, as I believe we already have another Robert on the list. But let me welcome them and all the other lovely and variously named folks that have gone to patreon.com/AITH podcast and signed up to receive monthly bonus content about Philadelphia theater history. Bless you and thank you all. So, on to our show for today. This story follows up on our trilogy of episodes that we released in the fall of 2022 entitled The Fight Against the Klansmen. If you haven't heard them, it's not completely necessary that you go back and find them, but you can at least go back to our website, www.aithpodcast.com, and read the blog posts about these episodes. I'll put all the links in the show notes, along with a link to another post about this episode as well. And of course, we will once again use our Season 3, the Tryout Town theme music, because although our topic today is about a film, a rather infamous film, not a play, it does fall right into the time period we are preparing to discuss, the early 20th century, as the Philadelphia theater world is transitioning from being controlled by the theatrical syndicate, and the world of vaudeville and legitimate theater is dealing with the prospect of this big new gorilla in American popular culture, the movies. Back in the year 1906, the prominent minister, popular public speaker, and best-selling author, Thomas Dixon, had written a new play based on two of his historically revisionist and white supremacist novels about the post-Civil War Reconstruction period. It was entitled The Klansmen. Basically, it was an origin story about the Ku Klux Klan, and believe me, Dixon was 100% pro-Klan and deeply alarmed about any prospect of black political power or what he would have ominously called race mixing. As we learned in our episodes about this play, Dixon had staged and produced a traveling combination company of the Klansmen, two companies, in fact, and these productions had produced considerable controversy and outrage all across the country from the African-American community. In quite a few cities, including Philadelphia, they had even succeeded in getting local authorities to ban productions of this play on the grounds that it threatened public safety and advocated for violence against black people. For a long time now, I've been intending to follow up on the promise I made to all of you a while back, that is to tell the story of what happened afterwards when that infamous film, Birth of a Nation, which was adapted from The Klansman, came to Philadelphia in 1915. And so now, I'm finally making good on that promise. It took me a little while to study up on the early history of American film and censorship, I admit, but now I'm all ready. So, what had Thomas Dixon Jr. been up to in the years since his play was banned in Philadelphia in the fall of 1906? Well, at first, as we mentioned, all that publicity that occurred when Philadelphia and many other American cities banned the play had actually only increased interest in it. So for a while, he did quite well. But then, as we also mentioned, Thomas Dixon rashly poured most of his profits from the play into the stock market and into cotton futures investments. And then he promptly lost them in the great financial panic of 1907. He even lost control of the production rights to the play, although, of course, he still owned the rights to the script itself. Over the next few years, interest in Thomas Dixon's novels and his career as a public speaker was also fading. Having made his point about his total hatred of miscegenation and black political power, Dixon's writings in this period largely railed against two other pet causes of his, the peril of socialism and the dangers of letting American women have the right to vote. These two topics were widely popular causes during the Progressive Era. Though, of course, socialism would never really gain total acceptance in America, Dixon was certainly behind the curve of history on the question of women's suffrage, which, before the end of the decade, would result in the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. And in the public mind, increasingly, Thomas Dixon was becoming just another crank, whom the time and the historic moment had passed by. And this was frustrating for the intensely ambitious and career-driven Thomas Dixon. Having once been firmly at the center of public attention, he could barely stand to be out of it again. But he did see a way back in. This was also exactly the period when movies and movie making were beginning to take hold of the American entertainment industry. Nickelodeons were springing up all over the place in American cities, and many vaudeville theaters were already exhibiting more movies than they did live performances. This was true in Philadelphia and true in the rest of the country as well. Thomas Dixon was quick to see the possibilities of this new medium as a vehicle for repackaging his old stories, like the Klansman, and for once again reigniting his political resentments. He was sure that the Klansman could easily be made into a moving picture. But, like many new technologies, it wasn't exactly clear what kind of movie making he should get involved in. There were many competing technologies. He didn't team up with Philadelphia's own Sidney Lubin's film studio, which was making a reputation in black and white silent shorts and even longer prestige projects. Instead, thinking that the spectacle of the Civil War battle scenes should best be seen with both sound and in color, Dixon instead attempted to get the Klansman on film using a new technology called Kinema Color, with a K. He and his old theater producing partner, George Brennan, teamed up with a California film director named William Haddox, who was a big advocate of this Kinema Color. They even filmed some scenes from the play on location at a plantation in Natchez, Mississippi in 1911 using the special Kinema Color cameras. But they never got more than a reel and a half of that film completed because they lacked further financing. They couldn't persuade any American theater owners and film exhibitors to commit to buy the special projection equipment it would take to actually show Kinema Color. So that project was put on the shelf, but the few scenes that they had been able to create were eventually exhibited around to other people in the trade around the city of Los Angeles, where increasingly the American film industry was being centered. This was where an early film reviewer named Frank Woods saw this footage, and he introduced Dixon to the film producer Harry Aitken and to the director D.W. Griffith. In 1908, Griffith, just as Dixon had been, was a failed theater actor and a playwright, but just 5 years later, in 1913, he had gone out to Los Angeles, he had suddenly found success in making films, and Griffith and Aiken had started working together on a film about Pancho Villa, and they already had a stable of film actors, including Lillian Gish. D.W. Griffith, just like Dixon, was a Southerner who held deep resentments about the Reconstruction period, which he regarded as having blighted his grandfather's life. Griffith promised Dixon $10,000 if he could make a film out of the Klansman. Though, because Griffith was still somewhat struggling financially, Dixon had to agree to just a quarter of that sum, plus a share of future profits. By 1914, Frank Woods had written a screenplay, Harry Aitken had gotten the financing together, and the work on the filming was underway. Originally, they used the working title, The Klansman, but then they settled on the much more grandiose The Birth of a Nation. The nation being born, of course, was the revived Southern white nation under the leadership of the Ku Klux Klan. Using the spacious fields of the California countryside around Los Angeles and the sound stages and backlots that were springing up all over Hollywood, the work on the film was completed after 8 full months of filming. Its cost ballooned to $100,000, an astounding sum for that time, but they thought it was worth it and they would make it all back. The battle scenes of the film were done with great accuracy, using advice from military historians. But the filmmakers also included many sequences which sprang directly from Thomas Dixon's darkest fantasies. Black Union soldiers accosting white women on the street in South Carolina, white abolitionists recoiling from the smell of black children, and even a scene showing the deportation of black people back to Africa with the subtitle Lincoln's Solution. You'll remember that Dixon revered Lincoln because he thought, inaccurately, that they shared the same ideological solution for the quote-unquote Negro problem, i.e. kicking them out of the country entirely. There was also a scene, which did make it into the final film, which showed President Lincoln's assassination in Ford's Theater on April 14, 1865. That's where the whole story begins, of course. And the movie was quite clear that John Wilkes Booth was evil and that Lincoln was good. While the historical recreation of the Reconstruction period afterwards is horribly portrayed, it's filled with all sorts of lies about supposed tyranny of uneducated black politicians and venal northern abolitionists and carpetbaggers. You know, that Reconstruction of a mid-19th century theater during the assassination in that movie, you know, that is quite astoundingly accurate. I have to admit that as a theater historian. I've even shown that footage to my own theater history classes. It's available on YouTube. It's easy to find. There isn't much else in the film I would show to students, except as a warning. But you know that one scene? Well, as I tell my classes before I show it to them, there's gold among the dross. Anyway, back to our story. It was a silent film. There were title cards, but there was no sound or dialogue. But Dixon and Aitken and Griffith commissioned a score to accompany the film, to be performed by live musicians. In fact, that's the music that I'm using to accompany this podcast episode. We're listening to it right now. And here's an interesting point. Both Griffith and Dixon were determined that this film was to be treated as much like a play as possible in its eventual exhibition. Now, part of this was due to the fact that the running time of the film, since it was a mammoth 12 reels long when it was completed, would take about 2 hours to exhibit. And most people back in 1915 thought that watching flickering movie screens for that long would hurt their eyes, so they were a little worried about that. But, well, you know, if it was a play, okay, we get that, a 2-hour-long play, that's understandable, we can handle that. The other reason for treating it like a play was about censorship. In early 1915, film censorship was widespread in America. The moral panic about what was being shown on all these movie screens was everywhere. First, people were worried about nudity. Of course, not just female nudity, but male nudity. Boxing films, for example, documentaries of actual boxing matches, were suspect because they showed men striving with each other on the screen, stripped to the waist with all their muscles bulging. And when the black boxer Jack Johnson was shown in his matches in all his physical glory on the screen, a lot of white people just flipped out. Implications of interracial sex in such early films as The Cheat, in which a lascivious Japanese gangster attempts to rape a white woman, had whole American churches up in outrage when it was exhibited. There was also a great worry about the religious and political content of films, as well as the supposed glorification of crime that were in many of them, and the supposed loose morals of both the filmmakers and the exhibitors, many of whom were immigrants, of course, and to many people's minds, Jews, you know? Chicago had set up a censorship law as early as 1907, and Pennsylvania was to follow in 1912. Every film reel shown in the state had to have, quote, approved by the Pennsylvania State Board of Censors, stamped on it. Looking at the list of published do's and don'ts that the Pennsylvania State Board of Censors sent out, it looks like Pennsylvania was really not okay with images of women drinking and smoking. That seemed to be the thing that bothered them the most. And many smaller states, even if they didn't set up their own boards, just went along with whatever the other big states did. But some municipalities and counties wrote their own rules. There were many overlapping censorship authorities all over the country. In fact, one early American filmmaker complained that it was like appeasing dozens of different Sunday schools all at once. And despite industry efforts to police itself, it was rumored that federal censorship eventually was coming. And here's the thing. In February 1915, as The Birth of a Nation was about to be released to the public, a landmark Supreme Court decision came down, which was called Mutual versus Ohio. According to the Supreme Court, filmmaking, unlike theater, was a business and not an art form. So the protections of free speech did not apply to it. Censor away. If you were a theater producer, you could appeal to the courts about the unconstitutionality of local laws trying to shut you down. But if you were a filmmaker, well, your products were fair game. And this decision was to stand up until the 1960s, in fact. So when Birth of a Nation first opened, it was originally shown in Los Angeles, but its big formal opening was in Boston. It undertook a careful marketing campaign. It was a film about history, they insisted, and it carried a valuable moral and political lesson. And most of all, said the filmmakers, it was a play. On April 9th, 1915, the 50th anniversary of General Lee's surrender to Grant at the Appomattox Courthouse, The Birth of a Nation opened at the Tremont Theater in Boston. Now, the Tremont was a legit house, which had been fitted up with a movie screen just for this occasion. The ushers in the theater were dressed in mid-19th century costumes to show people to their numbered seats, and others of them stood around in Civil War soldiers' uniforms, flanking the auditorium. There was a live orchestra in the pit, ready to play this special score that Dixon and Griffith had commissioned to accompany the action. But the first thing that the Boston audience saw on the screen was a title card, which had been placed there by that film industry group called the NBC, the National Board of Censors, which stated that this movie was, quote, a historical presentation and not meant to reflect upon any race or people of today. But these cards were meant to placate white audiences. If they had any guilt about black protests over this movie, and just as has been the case in the Walnut Street Theater back in 1906, a lot of black people, for their part, sure weren't buying that line. Once again, in Boston, there were angry demonstrations outside the theater, sponsored by the newly formed NAACP. In fact, the NAACP was largely formed as a method of protesting this film. And once again, there were eggs being thrown and angry words being tossed around inside the theater. Boston Mayor James Curley, wanting to placate his African-American constituency, had demanded that certain cuts be made of some of the most offensive title cards and scenes in the movie, but despite promises from the exhibitors, apparently this was just not done. Nonetheless, despite these protests from civil rights group continuing, the film received rave reviews in the white press of the day. The country was just mad for Civil War history in the early 20th century, and depictions of the battle scenes in the movie, actually seeing them, which formerly people had only had read about in books, just blew people away. The exhibitors slowly moved on from one large northeastern city to the next. This was the same strategy that Dixon had employed when he had first began staging the Klansman, remember? So the movie was shown in New York, in Los Angeles, and Chicago, always in high-class, former legit theaters, always with reserved seats, and each person who sat down in those seats got a special 12-page souvenir program. It was just like a play. The film kept on in this triumphal progress. President Woodrow Wilson famously showed it at the White House to his cabinet and all his friends, doing a favor for his old college buddy. Just as alarming, at a special showing in Raleigh, North Carolina, the entire U.S. Supreme Court were in the audience, as were many members of Congress and members of the diplomatic corps, the Secretary of the Navy, 38 U.S. senators, and about 50 members of the House of Representatives. And, according to press accounts, the audience of 600 people in all cheered and applauded throughout. So, you know, the political establishment was on board. It also ran in Atlantic City, New Jersey, during the summer months of July and August. So it's likely that many Philadelphians first saw The Birth of a Nation there while on summer vacation. In September of 1915, it was finally booked for Philadelphia. The birthplace of the actual nation was now going to see The Birth of a Nation. It had received the necessary approval from that Pennsylvania Board of Film Censors. No women were shown smoking or drinking in it, after all. Still, the film studio was careful with Philly because they knew that the original source material for it had been banned there in 1906, and it was still an open legal question whether that ban stood about the film. There wasn't a great distinction between plays and movies in those days, so maybe it was really the same thing. But even if the current mayor, Mayor Blankenberg, and his director of public safety, George D. Porter, forbade the movie's public exhibition in Philadelphia, would the courts then uphold that ban? In Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, on the other side of the state, the mayor of that city, after having received a delegation of outraged black citizens, had banned the movie. But then a Pittsburgh judge, pointing out that the state board of censors had already passed on it, declared that their authority trumped any local jurisdiction. And unless there were real riots being caused by it, he couldn't uphold the ban, and so it was allowed to be shown. Would that happen again in Philadelphia? There was certainly a great deal of outrage again, and again, it was mostly the black community that spoke out against it. There isn't a great deal of evidence about what is sometimes called today allies in the white majority speaking out against this film. Jane Addams of the famous Hull House in Chicago wrote a letter of protest, which was published in the papers, as did Rabbi Samuel Wise in New York. But I can't find many similar voices in Philadelphia. One supposed white progressive ally voice, Dr. Charlotte Abbey, who for years had worked in medical clinics alongside black medical professionals, well, she actually praised the film. Again, she loved its history. Nobody seemed to stand up for the memory of former Pennsylvania Congressman Thaddeus Stevens, who was viciously parodied in both the play and the film. Nobody, that is, except for black professional men and women of the day. The Philadelphia Tribune, the leading black newspaper in the city, wrote, "Possibly the most enthusiastic meeting held this summer to arouse interest in the effort to suppress the production of the disgraceful photoplay, The Birth of a Nation, was held Tuesday, August 31st, at the Allen Chapel. The NAACP, the Philadelphia Professional Men's Club, the Baptist Ministers Conference, the Philadelphia AME Preachers Conference, and so forth, all were present at this meeting, but it turns out this time their work would be ineffective. The Forest Theater, that is the first one on Broad Street, had been booked for the showing of the movie in Philadelphia, and again, this was a large, legitimate house. It must have felt like they were protesting a play, and ads for Birth of a Nation were printed in all the Philadelphia papers in the amusement section, right amongst those for all the other live shows happening in town. On the first day scheduled for its showing at the Forest Theater, September 4th, 1915, Philadelphia city authorities finally made a decision. Director of Public Safety Porter informed the manager of the Forest Theater that the photoplay could not be shown in Philadelphia to protect public order. But you know, I'm wondering if Director Porter really expected that order to stick. After all, he knew that the Pittsburgh ban had already been overturned. Maybe he was just putting on a show, as it were, for Philadelphia's black Republican voters, and he wanted to demonstrate to them that he had at least tried. Tellingly, Porter was quoted in the newspapers as saying that actually, he personally liked the movie. Quote, "It is the best and most stupendous I have yet seen, and as an educational film, I think it is marvelous." But still, he didn't think it should be shown in Philadelphia. However, the local board of Philadelphia censors passed on the film, and a judge, when the theater owners applied to it, overturned the ban. The show went on. Over 1,000 Philadelphians attended on the first night, and they all got their commemorative programs. The events surrounding the Klansmen back in 1906 were not destined to be repeated in 1915. On this opening night, there were not thousands of protesters outside the theater blocking Broad Street. People inside the theater were arrested and removed for disorderly conduct, including three men named Lazarus Lewis, Richard Williams, and Hubert Hokert. And when these three were eventually arraigned in court, their attorney, black lawyer named G. Edward Dickinson, certainly had a lot to say. Quote, "This play is nothing more than an infamous, villainous, and diabolical attempt to depict the Negro as a brute," he declared. "Men who say it is history know nothing of the period of Reconstruction. This play is designed only to deprive the Negro of a good name and to reduce him to the condition in which he was before the immortal Lincoln loosened the shackles that held him fast." Joseph McCullers, who was the attorney for the Forest Theater in court that day, announced to the judge that, well, he was not pressing charges against the three men and asked that they be let go because, quote, "they were just dupes of people who had not grasped the proper meaning of the play. The film showed how the Negro had developed," he said, referring to the final scenes, which show Negro college men being trained to go off and live in Africa. "It does not," thundered Attorney Dickinson in reply. "It shows a pernicious effort to keep the Negro in a continual state of degradation." But as admirable as Mr. Dickinson's words were, they did not, in the end, have any effect. These protests were regarded by the court as ethnic special pleading, much like those of the Irishman who had protested against the Playboy of the Western World in 1909, as you'll remember, and the play, or the movie, or whatever it was allowed to go on. Mourned the editors of the Philadelphia Tribune, "the authorities who control such matters, whose business to forbid exhibitions that are false, immoral, and calculated to stir up strife among the people of the city, have deemed it safe, expedient, and good to permit the birth of a nation. But might does not make right." 4 weeks after this, the movie was still running, and the Tribune noted ruefully in another article from October the 2nd that, once again, it thought that the violence that the film would inspire might not be immediate, but it would be widespread and systemic. And once again, it carped about Thomas Dixon's bad interpretation of history in the film. Quote, "If the South hailed Abe Lincoln as its best friend, why did the Southerners rebel in the first place? Tom Dixon is a liar." In the long run, the birth of a nation ended up playing 3 solid months at the Forest Theater. And then it moved over to the nearby Garrick Theater, and where it ran through the month of December. It was reported in the white Philadelphia papers that 2, quote, near riots had happened outside the movie at certain times. So likely they were describing peaceful demonstrations outside the theater by black people that were, quote, checked by police. When finally the run ended at the end of 1915, the Philadelphia Inquirer declared in its pages, quote, "The immensity of The Birth of a Nation is one of the most widely discussed points of interest. As a production, it is tremendous in scope and prodigal in detail." The decision to market the film, in essence, as a historical and educational play that just happened to be on film, had ended up being a great success. After receiving widespread nationwide distribution, The Birth of a Nation ended up making a bundle for its creators, millions and millions of dollars. They could barely keep track of all the money from ticket sales. Even now, there's disputes about what the actual box office return was. They were charging $2 a head at some theaters, an unheard of amount for a movie. And it is still today cited as being the first real blockbuster film, and its receipts, tellingly, were only eventually eclipsed by the next big Southern Civil War movie, Gone with the Wind, in the 1930s. Some of these piles of money eventually made its way back to Thomas Dixon, of course. But, you know, in the ways of Hollywood, the studio managed to keep most of it for itself. D.W. Griffith went on to make many other epic films, of course. But fortunately, Thomas Dixon again took his money that he made from the film, invested it foolishly, and lost it all in the next stock market crash in 1929. He died in considerably straitened economic circumstances in 1937. But what can we make of this renewed effort to stop the movie in Philadelphia? Well, as we've seen paradoxically, the fact that there was an official censorship board for movies actually ended up protecting the film. But more importantly, the fact that almost the entire white political class of the day approved of the movie, even enthusiastically supported its message, meant that there was never a real chance that it would be controlled or censured, even in the court of public opinion, at least white public opinion. Meanwhile, the influence of the movie that glamorized the Ku Klux Klan certainly had a great deal to do with the subsequent rise in the modern Klan in the 1920s and the rise in violence against black people throughout the 19-teens and 20s, which now spread far outside the South, especially in the American Midwest and even in the Northeast. It wasn't until the 1960s that black Philadelphians would finally gain enough political power to begin to have an effect on the culture of the city. In 1964, the local NAACP chapter would finally get blackface portrayal banned from the Mummers Parade, for example. But in the first half of the 20th century, as we've seen in our episodes about censorship and public debates and the propriety and decencies of plays, it was almost never going to be racism or pernicious historical myths that were going to be matters of dispute. After all, we had to protect the children from ladies wearing too little clothing or smoking, important stuff like that. Anyway, that's our episode for today. It's actually turned out to be an important refresher on a lot of topics we covered in season 2 and sets us up to continue the stories that we'll be covering in season 3. If you haven't already done so, subscribe and like our podcast feed on whatever app you're using. Please consider taking a few minutes to leave a review about the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or right on our website. That helps us out so much. And we'll be back soon with our episode about vaudeville in Philadelphia. Thank you for listening, and thank you, as always, for coming along on another adventure in theater history, Philadelphia.